Good morning, everybody. Good morning, Yana. Today is Tuesday, August the 16th. Somebody forgot she was on air this morning, so we're doing the old-fashioned phone thing. Just want to make sure we haven't lost her in the last 15 seconds from when we were talking before coming on air.
No, I'm here. I just forgot where I was supposed to be this morning.
All right.
I bet no one's ever had that happen before, right?
No. Are you ready for our Why Do We Say That?
Oh, sure.
Why do we say groggy?
Right. Because that's fitting for me today. groggy means dazed or a little slow, right? So it must have something to do with some type of intoxication or alcohol.
Kind of.
Or lack of sleep.
Now you're getting a little bit closer. Anytime you get up in the morning feeling a bit groggy, take pity on the 18th century British seaman. Admiral Edwin Vernon was a fine-looking figure standing on the poop deck of a vessel wearing a luxurious coat. Many of his men under his command despised him, and as a gesture of contempt, they used Old Grog to name the man identified by his grogham coat. At the height of his career, the admiral issued an order that was brand new to Her Majesty's Navy. Henceforth and hereafter, he stipulated, every cask of rum must be diluted with water before any drinks were served. Furious sailors gave the watered-down beverage the name of the man who had invented it. Even though it wasn't as potent as rum, grog could make a fellow dizzy in a short order. Hence, anyone inclined to wobble while walking came to be described as being groggy.
Well, so this that's me today.
This was not alcohol induced, I'm sensing.
No. Would never think of that.
Gotcha. Well, I would imagine you're getting lots of phone calls from a lot of aces and people who want to know more information with the fires that are going on in Siskiyou County, the ones in Humboldt and Trinity County. And any of the other ones that are populating our state about how come and why is it so much and. Is this a lesson for forest management?
Well, it's a good question. There's the two fires that are, the fire complexes that are closer to us, or the series that's out near Willow Creek. Those were all lightning ignited. We knew that monsoonal weather was coming, and the difficulty is just anticipating where exactly those cells are going to come down and whether they're going to find a receptive fuel bed, meaning that they'll be able to ignite something and carry a fire. So that's not entirely unexpected. I have been staying out of the way, though I've been getting some reports that the burn conditions have been pretty moderate so far, and it'll be interesting to see how much high-severity fire we get out of this. It might in fact be that we get some good fire coming from this set of lightning-ignited fires. There's also the whole complex over in the McKinney Fire, which is near Etna and Wairika, and that it's still not clear exactly what the ignition source was, but it certainly was a high wind event time period, and so I'm sure there'll be some interesting analysis that comes out of that one.
So as the terrain is a little bit different here between those two complexes, as well as like with Yosemite and the fires there, how much does terrain influence the management decisions that are made either obviously before or after a fire? Is that a limiting factor or a contributing factor at all?
Certainly, topography is a contributing factor to fire behavior. There's a lot of considerations in the containment space and trying to figure out how you'd hold a line, understanding that you get fire dynamics that are associated with that terrain that create, the more rugged the terrain, the more steep the slopes, the more opportunity for challenge. But, you know, that's not really my full expertise. I more work in the pre-fire space than I do in the fire management suppression side of the equation.
Right. But as people are anticipating a fire season coming up or the aftermath now, you know, what is done with what is left? You know, does it get cleaned up? Does it lay fallow? Does it, you know, what is done in the aftermath, I think, is, doesn't that set up the conditions for the next round of whatever might be coming up?
Well, okay. I think there's two parts to your question there, and it's a good one. So, you know, if your home, for example, is at the top of a slope, because it has those beautiful views, the underside, the downhill side of your house, especially if you have a deck, is something to pay attention to and really think about fuels management in that downhill side of the property, because fire tends to run uphill. And as it burns uphill, it also preheats the advancing vegetation as the fire is climbing that slope and makes it drier and more primed to burn. So, you know, being in one of those situations is something that creates some additional concern from a fire protection viewpoint. So terrain, you know, at the property scales and at the home protection scales is super important to be aware of. Now, the post-fire question that you laid out there, you know, how do you deal with the post-fire cleanup side, and what can be done, what's accessible, where do you take that material, how do you get crews into those locations? I mean, that is very much site-specifically driven, but the harder to operate, the more difficult it is to do post-fire cleanup work. So, meaning that if you're on steeper slopes, if you don't have road access, all those conditions increase logging costs or harvest costs. And so if you're, you know, needing to take trees down because they've been burned and they're now dead, their value is diminished already. And if the costs are a little bit higher in one location than another, the logical person would work where it's a little bit less costly first and hope you might have a market for either merchandising and selling logs or a way to dispose of those burned and damaged trees.
KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:19.
Hi there, and good evening, and welcome to the Jim Bohannon Show from Westwood One Radio. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. Weekdays at 7 p.m., it's the Jim Bohannon Show. I'm Jim Bohannon. Join me here on KINS.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Times, 8:24. We're back talking shop this morning with Jana Valakovic from the UC Cooperative Extension at Spruce Point. Jana, with the fires, it's intriguing. You said that most fire runs up a slope, but how does it not also run down the slope to get over the ridge, or is that the sparks that kind of kick out in front of it that allow it to go down the slope on the other side of a ridge?
So there's a lot of dynamics at play there. And, you know, again, there's a combination of topography-induced behavior, weather-induced behavior, and then the fuel dynamics that are present, what kind of vegetation you have. So when you've got some, you know, wind behind it, you're going to see you know, fire move a little more quickly, and you might get the distribution of burning pieces of vegetation called firebrands or embers, and those can help, you know, push the main fire front and advance in front of it, developing spot fires before the main front, you know, collects up to and connects up to those additional spot fires. So it's a combination of factors there.
What is the obligation after a fire comes through, whether it's private land or public lands? Is there any requirement to clean it up, or is that the property owner's full discretion?
Well, let's talk about in the private land context, in which Cal Fire will probably be the responsible fire agent for a private land setting, and they will likely, you know, be a part of the suppression efforts, and then during that effort, there'll be fire lines that'll be created. Some will be by hand, and some will be by machinery, often a dozer or something to that effect. There's a set of standards around making sure that after the crew has left the site, that the soil that has been disturbed is not going to carry and channel water and cause damage. So those fire lines will be, if we use the term, put to bed, meaning that there'll be some water bars put in or some ways to collect the water and put it into a safe location so that it doesn't go directly to the streams and cause an additional kind of sediment issue.
So the sediment settles out in that scenario and doesn't, not as much gets into the primary water channels?
Right. I mean, you can imagine, you know, a fire line might look really different than how you build a road. It might go straight up and down a slope, you know, following a ridge, coming off the ridge and going up and down, in which case you can imagine that could collect a lot of water. You wouldn't build a road that way. So
right,
what you're trying to do is be able to think about sort of the future impact of that, you know, a level of soil disturbance. There may be some mulching that is additionally required. So those are the basic stuff, trying to think about, you know, what the effect of suppression was on the area that was involved in the fire. Now, the question about what happens respective to the dead trees and the power lines and all of those issues, if it's in our jurisdiction, it will probably be PG&E. They will come through and make sure that the lines are in good shape and that the poles have been not damaged and all of that kind of stuff. But after that, it really lands to the homeowner, the landowner, to be able to think about those remaining impacts and develop a plan to address the damaged trees, whether they're dead or just damaged. And there are a lot of support resources that come in through, like Cal Fire has a specific program, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, which is a U.S. Department of Agricultural program. They have resources to help in kind of the restoration set of issues that may be needed. One example is that culverts, if they're plastic, can burn. And so you can drive over your road and discover that if you get out of the vehicle, that what used to be a plastic culvert is no longer present. So there are additional issues that need to be addressed outside of the tree management piece. If there are home sites that were burned or other issues, the County Office of Emergency Services and other, if it became a big incident, will help the homeowner think about the cleanup side, and it may be coordinated to be able to manage all of that contaminated debris.
With all the
coming back to
the reports that are the environmental documentation, is there a fast track for this, or is that treated just as any other project and has to go through that process?
Right. On the state side, there is a bit of a fast track, but there's still a need to file permits to do tree removal and to develop a management plan for the roads that the water board wants to have some information about. So it's not a free pass completely. It's certainly an expedited process, understanding that it's an emergency in that moment. When I work with landowners, we talk about that emergency only exists for a year. So the permitting ease can be a bit of a motivation to take care of issues on the early side, because once the year is up, then the emergency has passed. So that becomes an important factor in consideration.
KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:30.
Something big.
Okay, it's a nice ride.
It's going to happen.
Stand by playback.
And now.
Live. Real Red Meat Radio.
I keep forgetting I'm president.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
And these kids who come, they become Americans before a lot of Americans become Americans.
Now, here's your host, Lars Larson.
Hey there, it's Lars Larson. Join me for the Lars Larson Show, weeknights 10 to midnight. Honestly provocative talk radio on KINS.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:35. We're back talking shop this morning with Jana Valakovic. Jana, the concept of some of the fires, you know, you've talked in the past about defensible space and vegetation planning and be thinking about overhanging this and overhanging that. But when it comes to showtime, at that point, it's, okay, what do we do? How do we do it? How do we get out properly and safely? And I think a lot of our areas, there aren't that many options on how to get out of a certain area. You know, maybe there's two. So if one is blocked off, okay, everybody is being funneled into one direction. I would think that that's part of the planning for an evacuation that the individuals in these rural settings want to go through.
You're absolutely right. I think what's interesting about what's happened in the last week around Willow Creek is it's just a reminder of how quickly conditions can change, and sometimes we get comfortable in the coast communities thinking that fire won't happen here, but that's, we know that's incorrect, but we just want to, you know, we're hopeful for that outcome. But if it does, you know, how well prepared are we? What are our family plans? What do they look like? And if we have, you know, the benefit of some time, you know, what do you do in front of the anticipated evacuation recommendation when it moves from, you know, a warning to an order? So I talk about, like, the six-hour plan, things that people can do in advance, knowing that an evacuation may be coming, and how can you set up your home in the best possible condition, and then also be able to anticipate which direction your options are for evacuation. Do you have two ways in and two ways out? If you don't, you know, get out early, absolutely get out early. But if you, you know, you've got, you know, the benefit of a little more time, then what do you do in those last minute, what's in your checklist for your last minute actions? So for me, in my 4 to 6 hour plan, I'm closing the windows, I'm closing the skylight, the pet doors, and I'm thinking about where embers might land, and whether they'll find some receptive leaves or debris or grass. And so, you know, that might mean I'm taking my combustible doormat and throwing it inside the house, pulling the cushions off my, you know, patio or deck furniture, relocating the propane tank either far away, like the portable barbecue propane tank, either far away from the property or storing it inside. And then I'm thinking about how to seal up my vents if I haven't been able to upgrade them to the ember-resistant vents. And you can use tinfoil as a low-cost, quick effort. You can also use foil metal tape, known as bitumen tape. I keep a roll of that bitumen tape around. During the August fire, I have a cabin, and I was clearly not anywhere near the cabin. I wasn't able to get back in for several weeks. And what surprised me was when I opened my front door that there was a plume of ash that had blown underneath my front door into my main space by about 6 feet. Fortunately, that ash was cool. But had it been, you know, filled with hot embers, I probably would have lost the structure. So now in the summertime, because I haven't quite gotten my weather stripping altogether or my door, I use that bitumen tape and I just seal over the bottom threshold of my door. You know, it cost me 10 cents in that metal tape, but I think it'll make a significant difference.
When you're talking about the caps, are you talking about like the air pipes, the plumbing, that kind of stuff that oftentimes are open?
No, I'm talking about the vents themselves. So you've got foundation vents, you've got attic and under eave vents. You know, so you may be climbing to the attic and sealing the vents off from the inside, or you could have some plywood covers that you might install quickly if you have the time.
So kind of like storm shutters, you know.
Exactly. In that hurricane concept.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, when you see in hurricane country, people put, you know, plywood over their windows. Well, you could do the same thing over your vents in a temporary application. And it could be aluminum foil for that matter, right? It doesn't have to be that tough. It's just you're trying to keep it so that things don't blow through those vents. I probably pull a ladder out. I pull some garbage cans and fill those with water. If you don't have a firebox with an obvious location for where all your water and resources are, I'd make that more accessible on the chance that A, you hang on to your water, and B, someone is able to come and do some additional work at your place. So those are some of the things that you do in that, you know, that kind of 6-hour framework, in addition to loading your livestock, packing your vehicle, dressing for the evacuation, which means, you know, ways to cover your airway, a hat to keep, you know, your hair from catching on fire, sturdy shoes, preferably leather, cotton or wool clothing, gloves, leather gloves, and maybe some tools, because if the conditions change and you've got some difficulty getting out, you may need to go a different way. You know, for those that are in the rural country, that might mean you have to go through someone else's property through a gate. So you might want some bolt cutters or some other way to get yourself out if the conditions change quickly and the Office of Emergency Services and Sheriff's Office haven't been able to get contact to you.
So do you play the absolute worst case scenario, likely scenario? How far out do you go?
You know, for me, I kind of play the worst case scenario because I think it's a better idea to go through that exercise mentally so that you're ready. And depending on, you know, who's in your family, you might send other people out first. This is in advance, right? The evacuation order hasn't been required yet. It's really just saying there's a fire nearby. What are you going to do in this time period where you have the benefit of time? You may not. In fact, you know, you may not get an alert, or, you know, the like in this case, those lightning fires ignited in the middle of the night. Had things been, you know, more windy behind them, the conditions could have changed rather quickly, in which case you're moving real fast and don't have the benefit of those time periods to take care of those actions. So in the fire season, you know, have your go bag in the trunk of your car, or, you know, by your front door, so you're able to get out quickly.
KINS News and Information Time. It's 8:42.
Hi, folks. Fly Humboldt wants to remind you that flying local is buying local. And with airlines going to seven cities serving hundreds of destinations, it's easier than ever to get to where you want to go from Humboldt County's airport. That's right, you can fly on American, Avelo, and United Airlines nonstop to Denver, Hollywood, Burbank, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. Flying has never been more convenient or affordable, so book your trip now. For more information, go to flyhumboldt.org.
Good morning, KINS News and Information Time. It's 8:47. We're back talking shop this morning with Jana Valakovic from the UC Cooperative Extension. That means that they're cooperative people, right?
Well, we're that, and we're also in cooperation between county government and University of California. So
you could have just said yes.
Give a shout out to our county supervisors for sticking with us and making sure that that partnership is sustained and continues to flourish.
Is the governor kicking in any extra money through the education, through the UC part?
Well, last year we got our budget restored, so no planned cuts this year, so that's good. And things are holding steady.
Oh, good. So
good times.
You can sleep at night.
I can. And we're actually bringing on new staff, so that's a good time.
Oh, really? Support staff or a new area of expertise?
Two pieces of expertise. We just made an offer to a gentleman who will become our new economic development advisor, focusing on rural communities and agriculture and natural resource-based products, and covering Del Norte and Humboldt and also Trinity County. And then we're in active recruitment right now for our horticulture and specialty crops agriculture advisor.
Specialty crops being what? Like the flowers?
Well, not corn, soybeans, those kinds of things, but more the unique products that we grow here.
Is that code speak for anything?
No, it's not. I mean, we grow quinoa here, for example. There's nowhere else in California. They grow quinoa.
Yeah, how'd that happen?
There's a burgeoning wasabi industry. There's, you know, there are some unique crops.
All right. Well, if wasabi's in the equation, then I'm 100% comfortable.
Okay, great.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, our last conversation, we were talking about last-minute things to do, and this is not maybe a last-minute thing to do. It's a good thing to do any time of the year, and that is to take your cell phone out, if you have one, and make a video of what your house looks like and the things you have in it, because there's always the potential that we might lose our home to some kind of disaster. And in the insurance process, it's a really nice idea to have a sense of what contents you have in your building.
Well, that's
so
why
you can file that.
I was thinking, as you were talking about the go bags and be prepared and this and that, I'm thinking, you know, we had a little reminder with those two small earthquakes in the last couple of days.
Right.
It's like, you know, there are a lot of parallels between being prepared and being prepared for fire. So you talked about those situations where you had a little bit of lead time. What about, you know, you mentioned the go bag, and I think most people are familiar with the concept, even though we may not have one already set.
Right, exactly. It's the same stuff between earthquakes and tsunamis and wildfire in terms of what goes in the go bag, except for that you may have a little bit more rugged clothing that you need for the wildfire evacuation space. The other thing I hear people really stress out about is what they do with their keys in the last minute as they're beginning to panic and trying to hold it all together. And it's a common practice to lose your keys. So
really?
Yeah. So, you know, just being thoughtful and going through the exercise, making it somewhat routine, is a really great idea. And when families come together for the holidays, you know, talking about what the emergency plan is for a variety of natural disasters, and having a sense of where your communication points are, where you're going to, you know, maybe so-and-so outside of Northern California, mom, dad, somebody, that's who everybody calls, so that there's a clear line of who knows where everyone is.
There's not
an additional panic.
Right. Not hiding the keys inside the stuffing.
Right. But just, you know, where do people go? Where do
right.
they deploy?
Right.
The other thing that I hear a lot of people talk about is just assumption when it comes to wildfire that they're going to be home and they're going to have the time to do that 6-hour checklist and take care of those actions and do all the things. But there's a high probability that when a wildfire ignites, you might not be home. And your property may not be set up quite in the way that you want it to be. So if you're in a rural community and you're going to town, pay attention to the fire weather of the day and be thoughtful about what are some of those things you might want to do as you go to town on a regular routine day, but maybe it's a red flag warning day. And so what would you like done? Would you like those windows closed? Would you like the skylight closed? Would you like the garage door sealed so that, you know, embers aren't going to penetrate?
Yeah, that puts a whole different level of seriousness and thought, you know, particularly for a lot of our folks. You know, you may live in a rural setting and commute into work each day. Well, okay, that's a whole different dynamic, having to do that every morning rather than once a week kind of thing.
And for the really ultra-organized, like, I've seen people with a whole binder of everything written out and what they need to do, because it's easier just to go through the list and go check, 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 check. I've done 1 through 5. Hey, honey, will you do 5 through 10? You know, just everyone sort of knows their routine. They know what they need to do. They go through the list as they leave, and they feel better, right? Because it's hard to remember everything when an emergency's under play.
Is this information on your guys' website so somebody
can download
it?
Yeah, we have a lot of resources on our University of California Fire website, and if you just search University of California and wildfire, you can find our resources, and there's a set of checklists for the 0 to 60 minutes, the 1 hour to 1.5 hour actions, the 4 to 6 hour actions, and then there's a whole lot of things that are worth doing all around.
And maybe even your smiling face. Thanks for coming by, Yana.
Maybe.
Sorta. See you next month.
All right. Well, be safe out there. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. See everybody tomorrow.
Bye.